Hi, and welcome to Forest of the Future, the podcast where we explore innovation, policy, and action for sustainable forestry and responsible sourcing. In this episode, we are focusing on one of the most consequential regulations affecting global forest product supply chains today, the EU Deforestation Regulation, or UDR. This conversation was recorded in October, just one day after a major announcement about a possible additional delay of the regulation. We choose to release it now, while we wait for the final decision on this potential delay. And why are we releasing it a few months after recording? Because the content here moves beyond headlines and towards what you can actually expect in implementation. We look at what competent authorities will look at in their audits. We look at what companies are struggling with in practice and why systems like FSC remain essential, not just for compliance, but for moving towards real forest positive impact. While this law originates in Europe, its implications are global. So let's dive straight into what it means in practice. But before we get to the policy detail or global context, let's start with what many companies are asking for first. What will enforcement actually look like? To answer that, we begin with the Dutch competent authority, which has already conducted trial inspections and has years of experience in enforcing forest-related regulation. Their insights give us a very concrete picture of what due diligence really means under EUDR.
My name is Matteo Mascolo. I represent the Forest Stewardship Council International. I work on global sustainability policies in the EU, including on UDR. And it's really my pleasure to be your moderator for today. This webinar is about delivering UDR, but it's also much more than that. It's about collective actions. It's about what we can do together in order to ensure a deforestation-free future. Of course, there have been a lot of news around UDR recently. And I think if we want to use a guiding question for today's webinar, it's really about what we can do about it. What we can do about it in order to ensure this collective action for a deforestation-free future, because there is always one thing that we can do about it together in particular in order to deliver UDR and make the deforestation-free future a reality for all of us. It's really my pleasure to introduce you, Ms. Jessica van Zetten, Senior Inspector UDR at the Dutch Food and Product Safety Authority. She's going to share with us insight from the UDR Dutch competent authorities, in particular from verification process, certain audits that they've done with voluntary inspections with companies. So Jessica, the floor is all yours.
Well, thank you, Matteo. Today I'm going to tell you something about the Dutch competent authority and the approach that we're taking towards the EUDR. We have been given a lot of time by the Commission in order to prepare. Last year, before the first delay in the EUDR, we have hired around 10 new people, and that gave us the opportunity to at first set up a training system for all our new inspectors, but also to perform some dry runs, as we call them. So some trial inspections in order to establish the readiness of companies for the EUDR. What we have also been doing is a bit of the same action that the Commission took, and that is that we have been given a lot of public presentations throughout all sectors. I think at this moment in time, we're counting 200 or even more, in which we are trying to inform all relevant sectors, all relevant companies, to what do we expect from them in order to adhere to the regulation as it is at this moment in time. I will first tell a little bit more about the enforcement that we are doing. We have been enforcing the EUTR, of course, since 2013 already. So we have quite some experience on how to deal with this type of regulation. What we're going to do also under the EUDR is that we're going to select companies to inspect. We will do that risk-based and, of course, in the 1, 3 or 9% inspection cycle as is required from us by the regulation. If a company is then selected for inspection, we will request information from that operator or trader based on a specific due diligence statement that we have selected in Traces. Then we will ask that company to provide us with some details. We will ask them, okay, what did you do in order to establish that this specific delivery that you have put a due diligence statement on into Traces? How did you check that it was according to EUDR requirements? That said, we are also asking them to provide us with their due diligence system. So we will use the specific delivery to assess if the due diligence system is indeed working correctly and if it is robust to deal with deviations, new suppliers, etc., etc. By doing so, we're checking all the boxes of Article 9, Article 10, where necessary, Article 11 or 13, if that is used. So we are checking in this way that the company is meeting all requirements. If indeed the company is meeting them, then they are okay and they will get a letter saying, okay, you have succeeded the inspection. If they are not okay, then we will do a notice of remedial action, we call that. And that is that you will be given a time period in which you will be able to improve the due diligence system in order to meet the requirements. We will inform the specific company, okay, this is what we didn't see in your system, this is what you should cover. After a certain period of time, we will do a re-inspection. If the company is still not meeting the requirements, then we will take a specific fine from that company and give them another period of time. If at re-inspection the company is meeting the requirements, then all is fine and they will go back to the normal inspection cycle. If the company is faulty by intent, then we will make a criminal case out of the specific import or export of whatever is applicable. We are also obliged to make a publication of all operators and traders that were faulty. So one other thing I'm going to present today is something that we have learned from the test inspections that we have done last year. As I already said, in 2023, we hired more than 10 new inspectors and we already had a couple. So we had quite some capacity in order to, one, get them to familiarize themselves with the EUDR, but also to do these type of test inspections. We invited around 26 companies, out of which 20 participated in total. We have seen that they took a lot of effort in order to comply with the EUDR, but only 12 out of 20 were able to make a due diligence statement in Traces. Only 7 out of 20 collected enough information under Article 9, and only 9 out of 20 were able to tell us what they should have been collecting in order to meet the legislation requirements. Then 14 out of 20 assessed the risks, but only 3 out of the 14 assessed the risks sufficiently. Then 5 out of the 20 mitigated their identified risks in a satisfying manner, or according to our opinion. And then Article 12, 11 out of 20 had a due diligence system at this moment in time. And to conclude, 4 out of 20 had a good score initially, and 4 out of 20 scored good enough after some adjustments that we helped them with. So I want to share with you in quite a quick pace the 5 most important insights that we took from this exercise. So due diligence is more than collecting information. What we have seen is that some companies, they solely focus on Article 9. So they collected information in Article 9 and then just gave us that stack of paper. That isn't enough. The Article 9 information should be used to do the risk analysis and, if relevant, to mitigate the risks. Without analysis of your information, you can't draw any conclusion that a commodity is deforestation free or if they are meeting other requirements under EUDR. Then a second insight was that the use of platforms alone is not sufficient. We have seen that many companies think, okay, if I hire this or that type of platform, they will do all due diligence for me and there's nothing left for me to do then. If the competent authority arrives, print out the specific statements and give that to the competent authority. This is not due diligence. Due diligence is done by actively involving and incorporating that information that comes from these platforms into your internal systems and show us what is being done with this information. And also, a company should know what the platforms are using as inputs to draw a certain conclusion. Another point that we have seen, the design and the quality of the due diligence system is key to achieving compliance. So we have seen that the companies that have incorporated the EUDR requirements on specific positions within their company, they made the right decisions. So if your purchasing department knows what it should be doing, if the sales department knows, warehousing knows, etc., etc., we have seen that then most likely the companies succeed in adhering to the regulation. Then attention needs to be paid to the completeness of the due diligence exercise. We have seen companies that made a sort of a risk assessment tool for themselves, where they said, okay, I do see risks for deforestation, I see risks for legislation, but on, for example, human rights, the score is 10 out of 10, and for and geolocations or whatever, a score is also 10 out of 10. So that will then give a good overall score of, let's say, 8 out of 10. No, that's not how due diligence in this case works. So all risks should be assessed equally and should all meet all requirements. You can't sort of make an average out of it and then say, okay, we're complying. Then the last insight I would like to share is that the documentation needs to link the commodity to the production location. So let's say that a company has succeeded in establishing that on a certain plot of land, all requirements were met, geolocation points were known, they were deforestation free, legality was okay, all is fine on that plot of land. And they will show us that information in the Netherlands, and then they will say, okay, that product is coming from that plot of land. And then we say, okay, that's good, but show us how that happened. Because without the traceability components, you can't prove that that product was exactly coming from that plot of land. So you can't really prove anything about deforestation free or whatever. So to draw the conclusions, all companies that we have selected to do this due diligence exercise with, they done a lot of work in order to comply. We have seen them struggling with finding how should I then design a system, a due diligence system? How can I get the right legislative documents, etc., etc.? And we have appreciated their effort a lot. We have seen that all production locations that they have shown to us at that moment in time were deforestation free. So apparently the geolocation point wasn't that much of a problem, at least for the companies that we have worked with, and that around 40% of the companies have come very far with EUDR compliance.
Thank you very much, Jessica. Thank you for all these insights. And also I will say, if I may, Jessica, also kudos for the organization that have agreed on the voluntary inspection. So thank you very much for the work. And I think it's really important in light of what we have discussed today for the enforcement.
Let me pause, Matteo, right there. What we just heard shows how demanding EUDR will be in practice. But enforcement only really works if the rules are applied consistently across the EU. To understand why uniform implementation matters and what we can learn from past experience, Let's now turn to the legal perspective. Here is Michael Rice from Client Earth.
And now, so we're really pleased to have with us Client Earth. Client Earth is a global NGO, and I would say, if I may, it's a unique NGO. We have been working in many instances already with Client Earth, and it's a unique NGO because it's an NGO made up entirely of lawyers. They've been doing a lot of work. They've been working, in particular, Michael Rice, our speaker for today, has been working a lot on UDR, I would say, since day one. They've produced reports, they've explained how to apply the regulatory requirement, and I'm sure Michael will share with us useful insights on the delivery on UDR, but also focusing on the broader global landscape. With that said, it's really my pleasure to introduce you, Michael Rice, Value Chain Strategy Investment Lead and Client Earth, who's going to focus on delivering UDR and uniform approach for the single market. Michael, the floor is yours.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Matteo. I'm proud to be speaking about the importance of the EUDR, I think especially at a time when its relevance is again being called into question. I think despite Commissioner Roswell's announcement yesterday, I'm confident that there's no turning back. There's been far too much momentum behind the EUDR to turn back now. Perhaps more momentum outside Europe than within the EU, but I think really the direction of travel is clear. There may well be changes. Let's wait and see. But there are still huge advantages in a uniform approach to tackling the EU's contribution to deforestation and forest degradation. And I'm going to explain why briefly, and also how civil society organizations like my own can contribute to the collective effort to achieve a deforestation-free future. The first and most obvious opportunity is to learn from the experience of the EU timber regulation. Now, this won't be news to FSC or any of your members, but the EUTR hasn't been implemented uniformly across the EU member states. This has created opportunities for circumvention and allowed illegal timber to continue flowing onto the EU market. The national authorities responsible for enforcing the rules in each member state have been, by and large, drastically under-resourced. Compliance checks have focused on procedural non-compliance, often by small operators, rather than tracking down big shipments of illegal timber, and very few sanctions have been imposed. In many member states, the rules have basically been ignored because there was no chance of them ever being enforced. Some member states have done a very good job, but their efforts have been undercut by the lack of enforcement in others. And unfortunately, we're still not seeing this system working properly, even in obvious cases. We've recently been working on illegal timber from Russia and Myanmar flowing into the EU in contravention of the EU's own sanctions. You know, these are illegal supply chains funding dictatorships. When we talk about collective action, there is one absolutely fundamental lesson we need to draw from over a decade of experience with the EU timber regulation. And that is, member states need to implement and enforce the rules. There is no impact if national enforcement and customs agencies don't have the resources, the staff, the expertise, or the support of their own governments to do their job properly. Now, the EUDR was designed to solve some of the problems which have undermined the impact of the EU timber regulation. The sort of structural improvements are listed here on the slide. You know, there's clear, explicit obligations on member states now to sufficiently resource their enforcement agencies, if that wasn't already clear enough or implicit under the EUTR. There are clearer standards for checks, when they should happen, what they should examine. There are clearer standards for member states in designing their own sanctions frameworks and, very importantly, an obligation to implement them. And quite importantly, scattered throughout the regulation are obligations on member state agencies to coordinate with each other, to share information, to cooperate, including cooperating with agencies of third countries where that's relevant, and generally to promote a uniform approach to implementing the rules across the EU. However, one precondition, you might say, to the uniform implementation of new rules is ensuring that all member states have the same understanding of the rules. And one way that an organization like Client Earth can contribute is to help explain the rules. I mean, it was interesting to see in the initial poll that still sort of understanding the requirements of the EUDR is one of the challenges. So we tried help. One example here is we noticed that member states were taking diverging views on the meaning of the EUDR's legality requirement. Now, this is the requirement that products must have been produced legally, just like under the EUTR, but framed more broadly in the EUDR. And one piece of work that I'd like to share is this briefing, which we published in April, that unpacks and explains this legality requirement. And to make sure that we got it right, we commissioned an independent legal advice from a retired EU Court of Justice judge to give us their opinion on the meaning and the scope of the law. And that legal opinion is publicly available. You can download it from our website. It's referenced in our briefing. And we hope that it contributes to a common understanding of this important legal requirement. Perhaps more directly relevant to supporting collective action is the additional research and analysis we went on to do together with in-country legal experts on the production of soy and cattle in Brazil, cocoa in Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire, and palm oil in Indonesia. And these case studies identify and explain the national and subnational laws applicable to commodity production in these countries that fall within the scope of the EUDR's legality requirement. So we explain the main legal requirements, and we point out some of the common risks that will be most relevant for EU operators conducting due diligence on their supply chains. The case studies include a number of recommendations for operators and competent authorities for ensuring compliance with the legality requirement. And unsurprisingly, the most obvious piece of advice is to consult local experts on local legal requirements and their implementation. And the main point here is that due diligence on the legality of a specific commodity production enterprise cannot be done solely from your desktop. Digital information needs to be cross-referenced with the reality on the ground, and consulting local experts and local stakeholders is the only way to do that. And this is where civil society organizations can play a critical role, both in Europe and in overseas producer countries. Our organizations have years of experience working on deforestation and illegality risks across commodity sectors, as well as expertise on evolving digital tools for supply chain mapping. Our networks include local experts who understand how commodity production really happens on the ground. And I think what unites this global civil society network is our shared ambition of a deforestation-free future. And that's where there's huge potential, I think, for real positive collaboration between private, public, and not-for-profit sectors. And let's be honest, I mean, the dream of a deforestation-free future really needs to come true. Yes, I think we can all acknowledge that the EUDR represents significant change for businesses, and change always comes at a cost. But as Matteo mentioned in the introduction, the cost of inaction is far, far greater. The cost for the security of our economy, our health, our climate, our food system, for the future of our children, but also for businesses who will face increasing legal risks for sourcing products linked to forests and their impacts on climate change or biodiversity. So if, again, we take a step back from the EUDR, we can see a clear trend in climate jurisprudence towards greater state and corporate accountability. And there have been some big recent judgments by European and international courts on these questions. And what we see is that the international legal community is converging on greater climate accountability and stronger climate action. These judgments clarify that states have a legal duty to regulate the private sector in line with the 1.5-degree target of the Paris Agreement, and that this includes imposing obligations on businesses to align their operations with the 1.5-degree target using science-based, time-bound actions. So again, here we see the direction of travel is clear, but there are two very different legal pathways to get there. The EUDR, on the one hand, provides a stable, uniform framework for minimizing the EU's climate and biodiversity footprint through its impacts on forests. And in the absence of that framework, we're likely to see litigation against states and corporates playing a much bigger role. The legal rules would then be made, you know, one judgment at a time with more uncertainty, as opposed to an EU-wide, cross-commodity, clear, black-and-white legal framework like the EUDR, which we already have, we already know, we just need to implement it. So thank you very much for listening. Back to you, Matteo.
Okay. So far, we heard what the authorities expect and why the legal framework matters. The next question is, how can companies realistically respond? Trevor Mell from FSC shares how FSC certification, data tools, and risk assessments are being adapted to support EUDR compliance, and why this goes beyond minimal legal requirements.
I'm going to hand over now to my colleague, to the next speaker from the Forest Stewardship Council International. Once again, big thanks to my colleague Trevor, the Director of Marketing at the Forest Stewardship Council International, and is going to speak about how to build a deforestation-free future, which, by the way, I really love the word building because it gives the idea of progress. This is something that we need always to strive for. And of course, the FSC solution for UDR and beyond, because there are some solutions for UDR and other legislation. Trevor, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Matteo. And I will take you through a short update of FSC's solutions and what we've been up to with regards to this implementation. But before I talk about our unique role, just to pause and reflect on the forces which are significant that are reshaping the forests and supply chain landscape. From a consumer perspective, their expectations and demands are clear. Many surveys, including our own research, does confirm that a clear majority of consumers demand and request wood-based products that come from sustainable sources. Over 70% place the responsibility directly on companies, not in users. And within this regulation, we talked a little bit about the spaghetti bowl is catching up. Due diligence used to be kind of a best practice for on a voluntary basis, and now it's a legal obligation. EUDR, of course, is the headline, but it's also part of a wider trend. The UK has its own law. The US is debating the Forest Act, and there's others. And enforcement is real. Penalties could run up to 4% of annual turnover. And the rules are increasingly no longer satisfied with paperwork. Data is the new currency. Traceability down to the plot with geolocation and digital verification is becoming mandatory. And all of this is happening against a backdrop of urgency. I think many of us know the stats around deforestation. In 2022, the world lost 6.6 million hectares of forest, most of this coming from primary tropical forest regions. And the global pledge to halt deforestation by 2030 is already off track. Add in some geopolitical shocks, the war in Ukraine, timber bans on Russia and Belarus, and you can see how compliance risk and political risks are converging and colliding, let's say. And of course, the stakes are really high. And this means, and I think what we can see here is that law, science, consumer trends, geopolitics are coming together. And what does that mean for companies? Companies that embrace transparent, traceable, and robust risk systems will not just survive the regulation and avoid the fines and reputational loss, but secure a resilient future for their business. And I'll show you some of these players who are doing this already shortly. And against that backdrop is FSC. We remain committed to deforestation-free supply chains in the future and protecting forests for all forever. So Many of you might have been in previous webinars knowing that this is a FSC-hosted webinar. This has been a global priority for FSC as an organization for 2 years now. We've rapidly created a lot of materials from a communication and engagement standpoint. If you're interested in seeing our microsite with all of this, you can scan this QR code. We've been educating our system, our more than 60,000 certificate holders, on what EUDR is, how it impacts them, how to implement it. And we've also rallied our staff around the globe, knowing that although this starts from the European Union, the impact is international. We've hired EUDR specialists, embedded them on our regional teams to help work with businesses to navigate this change, particularly in Asia Pacific, but also Latin America and Africa. And FSC is part of the EUDR multi-stakeholder platform. So we've been advising and working with the Commission directly. I have to say that's mostly Matteo here, and recently responded to the EU call for evidence. So our solutions here, and I think it's important to say that it's not just talking about EUDR, but this has also been a kind of make or break moment for FSC as a system too. We've seen the opportunity to ensure alignment with EUDR, and knowing that businesses are already showing their commitment to responsible forestry through FSC, we want to make it easier for them to deliver on that. So EUDR, in a way, has really guided our product development. And what you can see on the screen here is our offer that was presented last summer. It highlights the FSC certification at the core, which already meets a lot of the legality and sustainability requirements from EUDR, with a normative standards add-on as well as a technology layer. And what I'd like to do is give you three updates since last summer that are relevant to our progress here in the EUDR solutions. The first I'll touch on very lightly, because I'm going to come back to it briefly, is the regulatory module. So this is the voluntary additional requirements for certificate holders impacted by EUDR. It builds on top of our strong and rigorous system already. And for the 37 of you, I think I counted, who found risk assessments to be most challenging, this is for you. FSC is not new to the risk assessment game. FSC has had a robust library of risk assessments since 2014, which means we're very familiar with the methodology and conducting this on a global basis. We were already in a process to update our risk assessments, and when EUDR came along, we took the opportunity to add a handful of additional indicators for EUDR, as well as to address the policy for conversion. We're in the middle of an intensive process of updating 90 country risk assessments over the next few years. This process is already bearing fruits. Romania was recently the first next-gen risk assessment launched, and I heard just before this call that Austria was just internally approved as well. So that will be communicated soon. We're also nearing the final stages for Ukraine, Sweden, Canada, and Brazil. And we'll drop a link in the chat also if you want to look at the schedule for the other 90 that I mentioned as well. But part of this as well is making this accessible. So in the past, you would sort through dozens of pages and see which of the requirements and indicators are relevant for you. We've launched an interactive digital platform to make that more straightforward, to supplement your due diligence system. And the country risk assessments from FSC matter because without them, you have to create your own company risk assessment. And having a country risk assessment from FSC makes that a lot more straightforward, since much of it is solved at the national or potentially in the future subnational level. Finally, the other point is around FSC Trace, and see a couple of questions about this in the chat as well. So one sentence about what this is: FSC Trace delivers transparent and secure data sharing. So this is the blockchain technology, upgrades integrity with real-time verification, and is designed to make reporting efficient and more automated. We have begun onboarding organizations in a staged way, and I'll talk a little bit about how we've involved some of them in the process shortly. We're focused on onboarding the forest managers first. They have the data that makes all of this work. So that's the current priority, as well as priority access companies that will enable the data for the rest of the value chain. We are also progressing towards inviting our entire system by the end of the year to FSC Traits. Of course, these solutions are ideal for EUDR, but also have wider applicability for other regulatory due diligence and compliance needs as well. And it's important to mention that we haven't been building these solutions in a silo, but we've been bringing our market partners directly into the process. We had an early adopter program, which included 25 certificate holders and 4 certification bodies that represented different regions, different companies of different shapes and sizes, smallholder groups, and the commodities linked to EUDR, so rubber, wood, and fiber. We've been working with them on a couple of fronts, one on the regulatory side. So they've been filling out surveys and also participating in mock audits to make sure not only that, you know, what we create works in theory, but also in practice on the ground, as well as on the technology side. So this is getting in the platform, making sure that it works, fulfilling some of the core features and functionality, like matching transactions with trading partners as well. These two gentlemen on the screen here, Keelong is from Thailand, and the gentleman at the bottom is from Guatemala. They've both passed the audit and have a regulatory module claim. So in short, they're ready to go. And Keelong from Tatwin here represents a smallholder group, which I also note is a theme in the chat. So you can hear and learn from him at our APAC EUDR webinar next Tuesday. And back to the regulatory module a little bit, there have been several benchmarking exercises conducted by independent bodies so far, which as a side note, if you're interested in conducting your own, please do so. I'm always happy for the feedback. This is the latest one. It was just published yesterday. FSC commissioned Assurance Services International to analyze how FSC certification with the regulatory module aligns with EUDR guidance documents. The findings are clear. FSC certification with the regulatory module does ensure full alignment. You'll see here the FSC's core certification already meets the implementation, which is the tan box here, and governance criteria, the blue box, fully. On the standard side, which is the kind of teal color here, the core certification has a few criteria that are not fully green, meaning fully aligned. And here's where the regulatory module comes in. So that's how you ensure that full compatibility with the regulation. Meanwhile, we are channeling these feedback and findings into our ongoing national standard revision processes, which are reflected by those couple of orange and blue bubbles that you'll see here as well. So have a look at that if you'd like. And this is just one benchmarking. There are other efforts underway and some studies in progress as well. And we will publish those as soon as available. My final slide here is EUDR, and what we've been talking about is really the floor and the foundation of what's needed. FSC is engaged more beyond just EUDR in the regulation sense, and we're interested in building the ceiling. Deforestation regulations are essential and urgently needed, but healthy and resilient forests need more than a commitment simply to exist, but collective action to thrive. Stewardship for us has always been broader. So here's five areas I wanted to briefly highlight where FSC brings value beyond EUDR. The first is environmental and social safeguards. FSC aligns deforestation-free efforts with broader sustainability goals, incorporates biodiversity protection, ecosystem services, and community rights. EUDR addresses some of the social and broader environmental needs sparsely, if at all. So this is really where FSC comes in to add that additional value. The second point, we work across sectors and supply chains of all shapes and sizes, which means that certification isn't just a forestry tool, but really a practical way for companies to show that they align with EU rules, international deforestation-free frameworks, the spaghetti, and their own global sustainability strategies. FSC standards give companies a structured way to assess and manage risks in sourcing, scalable, flexible, and proven around the world. The third is the point that FSC does not work in isolation. We're constantly co-creating additional solutions with companies, civil society organizations, and communities to innovate forest management, supply chain traceability, and new deforestation-free models. Often we build on top of our rigorous certification system. For example, with FSC Verify Impact, we're expanding from tangible commodities like wood and rubber into areas, the intangible areas like carbon, biodiversity, water, and even cultural values. This creates new revenue streams for forest managers and credible claims for companies, which can open the door for conservation benefits that go far beyond the traditional market. Fourth point, credibility really matters. And FSC backs its system with integrity tools and independent assurances to fight the wrongdoers. I can mention here our powerful policy for association, which lets FSC expel those that commit serious human rights and environmental violations. We also have the remedy framework, which helps them get the support to right these harms. And finally, FSC is truly global. Our standards are recognized and used in every region, helping companies align not just with the EU rules, but also these international sustainability commitments. And because we're a multi-stakeholder system, our direction is set by our members across economic, social, and environmental spheres. And actually here next month is our FSC General Assembly in Panama. That same global community will come together, debate, and vote on the future of issues affecting forests and our future and FSC as a system. And all of this is really wouldn't work without the foundation of independent third-party verification, which makes all of this possible and credible. So whether the UDR deadline comes tomorrow or next year, FSC is here because our value goes far beyond compliance. And just a short message for the FSC certificate holders in the audience. You can and should feel comfort in knowing that you're not just committed to meeting UDR, but exceeding it. Your efforts mirror FSC's vision to protect the world's forests for future generations by advancing sustainable and transparent supply chains. You are operating at the highest level of responsible forest stewardship. So knowing that your sustainability bases are covered, which is the solutions that I mentioned and what we're supporting with, in the face of these dynamic and changing regulations, FSC is here to support you in being agile enough to take on what's next.
UDR may be a European law, but its effect reaches far beyond Europe. To understand how producer countries and global supply chains are adapting and where capacity gaps still exist, we now zoom out to the global perspective with insights from the World Bank.
I have the privilege to introduce you Mr. Melvin Spray, a senior trade specialist at the World Bank, who's going to use the case of UDR, but he's going to zoom out and he's going to share with us the perspective of the World Bank and what the World Bank is doing in this arena.
Yeah, thank you very much, Matteo, and good morning to all of you from Washington, D.C., where I am part of the global trade team in the World Bank. I would like to share some perspectives of the World Bank's activities in this area. And this will be based on work that is going on in the bank across different global practices. That includes the global practice that focuses on agriculture and food, environment, trade and competitiveness, but also our private sector arm in the World Bank Group, which is the International Finance Corporation. And in doing so, I would like to take also a somewhat broader perspective and sort of put the EUDR in a trend that we observe, which is kind of a new wave of due diligence regulations. What I will present will also be based on a forthcoming briefing note that the global trade team has put together, which includes recommendations for governments and also recommendations for development partners. So first of all, what we can observe is essentially a shifting regulatory landscape. So over the last, let's say 20 years or so, we've seen voluntary sustainability standards coming up to tackle, you know, a wide range of issues, be it climate change, biodiversity loss, labor conditions, but also deforestation. FSC is one of those examples. And those schemes have, of course, gained a lot of traction. There's also been some criticism on some of these schemes in terms of, you know, these schemes sometimes lacking transparency, exclusion of smallholders, certification costs, and so on. But what we can observe is that over the last, say, decade or so, that increasingly some governments are turning the requirements that are embedded in these schemes into mandatory requirements. And that's especially happening in some of the northern countries. And that is because those countries believe that climate change, biodiversity loss, you know, deforestation and so on require a stronger action. Although, you know, there's also criticism. There are also some countries that are saying, well, these are just, you know, new unjustified trade barriers. And it is true that international trade, in particular, global value chains can be a powerful way, a powerful means to drive sustainability. So there are examples of that in the United States, for example, the U.S. Lacey Act. You have in the U.K., for example, the Modern Slavery Act. But you also have EUDR. There hasn't been, you know, much research done on sort of this new trend of due diligence regulation. And I would like to give a shout out to some of the pioneering work that the International Institute for Sustainable Development, IISD, has done here. They've basically highlighted a number of recurring themes that we can also see popping up in the EUDR. So that is, for example, risk management. And if we focus in on the EUDR, Also, the EUDR requires countries to conduct risk assessments and also to mitigate risks. Transparency we see popping up in these laws. The ability to trace products throughout the value chain. In the EUDR, there's the obligation to provide geolocation data. Legality is very strong. Companies should comply with national laws and regulations. Again, in the case of the EUDR, that includes environmental protection, human rights, and so on. Accountability is strong. The need, for example, to submit due diligence statements and also stakeholder consultation. So essentially what we see is that global value chain structures are changing. We see shorter, concentrated value chains that involve multinationals, large-scale production that have invested in compliance. Many of these global value chains, they will be EUDR ready by the end of this year, or if there will be a postponement, also by a year later. And actually what we see, we all have seen the sort of the recent news about a possible further delay, is that some of the larger companies are actually against further delaying the EUDR. Nestle and Unilever and companies like Pirelli, they have all issued statements that as far as they are concerned, the law should be implemented. But we can also see complex, longer value chains with many small-scale producers where we see fragmented government and private sector data. These value chains struggle and they're much less likely to adapt. And these are the value chains that still need a lot of help and that possibly also, one could say, need more time. If we look at the landscape of the financial and technical assistance that's being provided, we all know that the EU has put in place an initiative. There are other development partners that provide assistance as well as NGOs. But more needs to be done. And we can also see that in some countries, the technical assistance is still, somewhat scattered, somewhat disjointed. And perhaps there is a role for the World Bank moving forward to play sort of a more convening role there as well. If we look at sort of building compliance based on sort of our experience so far, how do we respond to the EUDR? I would say that, what really helps is to have a lead agency to basically coordinate EUDR compliance across a range of ministries and other government agencies that tend to be involved. It's important to establish these multi-stakeholder platforms in the country. It's important, as we know, to identify the data sources to map the global value chain actors. Conducting a legal review is important. It's useful to have a comprehensive list of all the legislation, which could be important info, which could be a repository for companies when they have to conduct their due diligence. It's important to build stakeholder engagement and trust, especially across and between the public and the private sector. There are, of course, highly integrated global value chains where the private sector traces the production, and there may be little need for government involvement. We've seen some of those countries also in the World Bank, but much more often this really needs a joint sort of public and private sector approach. Financing plan, very important, identifying blended finance options, climate smart agriculture tools to support private sector investment, and also engaging development partners, assistance. Traceability, very important. And there, in many countries, there may have to be some integration of public and private sector data, and obviously monitoring and continuing improvement. The coordination between producing countries and the EU is essential to meet the expectations of the EU operators who ultimately are responsible for implementation, and also coordination between producing countries and the EU authorities. And for example, in some of the World Bank operations, we have had interactions with, for example, the European Cocoa Association, the European Coffee Federation, and we brought those organizations to the countries to tell the countries, like, listen, if you want to continue to import into the EU, these are the requirements and that we would expect you to meet. And these organizations also have their own protocols. Finally, the private sector, of course, wants clarity, wants stability, wants to have transparency. But I think this is kind of a new piece of legislation. And I think moving forward, first of all, a lot will be sort of characterized as learning by doing. What we see is that there's still a lot of, and especially in the smaller countries, I would say, a lot of analytical and operational gaps that remain, where we need more insight in sort of the structural weaknesses at farm and cooperative level. For many of those countries, the coordination between the public and the private sector and building trust is really key also in building a digital traceability systems. And perhaps more generally, I would say what we see, and this is also kind of an announcement for the next sort of World Bank's flagship report, the World Development Report, which will be issued in November this year and which will focus generally on standards for development. That's the topic of the World Development Report. And what we observe there is that there is a complex landscape of standards and regulations out there. There's an increase in standards and regulations. This spaghetti ball, some will call it, is becoming really overwhelming for exporters in developing countries. So that World Development Report will also include some recommendations of countries in that regard. And that includes continuing to prioritize harmonization, mutual recognition of standards, and also harmonization and mutual recognition of sustainability initiatives globally.
Finally, to ground the discussion in the current state of the regulation itself, we turn to the European Commission. This segment focuses on key simplification, the benchmarking approach, and the reasoning behind the proposed delay, all critical context for companies who are preparing for what comes next.
Without further ado, I would like to introduce Mr. Gábor Lovasi, Policy Officer at the European Commission DG Environment, really working in the unit of UDR. He has been working extensively on this topic. He's also responsible for many useful documents regarding implementation. He's going to speak about the state of play on UDR. Mr. Gábor Lovasi, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to speak about the state of play with the EUDR right now. As you know, the Commission is taking measures to assist with the implementation and to provide guidance on the EUDR. This is why the Commission delivered a package of instruments in April with pragmatic solutions to minimize the burden on economic operators and also other stakeholders while staying within the boundaries and objectives of the law as it already entered into force in the middle of 2023. As part of the package, the Commission published in April the fourth iteration of the FAQ and also an updated version of the guidance document. These updates reflect business requests for more clarity and also other aspects. For example, updated timelines about the entry into application, a decision table on the applicable legislation concerning products that are under the timber regulation, and also products that are new to the deforestation regulation. Some examples of key simplification measures introduced include, for example, a simplified understanding of what ascertaining means further down the supply chain for non-SME operators and traders to confirm that the due diligence has been carried out. Made a major simplification for rules or re-imports. We have clarified that operators do not have to exercise due diligence twice on such products which are re-imported, and operators may only refer to DDS, which was submitted at the time when the products were placed first on the European market. We clarified also specific situations where primary producers would not be considered as operators. These are based on the recent judgment of the Court of Justice of the European Union. As the Commission progressed with the implementation, we saw a need to clarify further myths and misunderstandings around the deforestation regulation. The main document addressing the most recurrent questions and earlier clarifications are outlined in the Mythbuster document. Regarding the benchmarking, in line with the Commission's commitment, the list of countries that present low or high risk of deforestation was published on 23rd of May in a Commission implementing regulation. The methodology for the benchmarking was outlined already last year in the annex to the strategic framework and was published in the implementing act after vote in favor by consensus by the member states. The main principles are fairness, objectivity, and transparency. It's based on the latest available evidence of internationally recognized data, which is the FAO Global Forest Resources Assessment. As you might have already seen, most of the countries in the world are listed in the low-risk category, meaning simplified due diligence for operators who are sourcing from these countries. They do not have to exercise risk assessment and risk mitigation by default, which is a simplification also compared to FIMA regulation. Those operators sourcing from low-risk countries are subject to fewer checks by the competent authorities. Regarding the information system of the UDR, this is the system to submit and manage due diligence statements by the operators and the non-SME downstream players in the supply chains. The user registration started since November 24, and two parallel systems were launched for submission in December 24. These two parallel systems are a so-called acceptance server, which is provided for familiarization or training within the information system, and the submissions there do not have legal value compared to the production system, which is the live server that hosts diligence statements that are submitted by operators and non-SME downstream players, and these submissions have a legal value. By September, we had over 350,000 DDS submitted, and this number is growing constantly. I provided a link to the information system website where you can get more information about the functioning of the system. As you might have heard, unfortunately, we have concerns regarding the IT system due to the way that the operators would interact with the system and the related load projections impacting the system itself. This comes from the context of our dialogue with stakeholders. New projections on the number of expected operations and interactions between economic operators and the IT system, which has led to a substantial reassessment of the projected load on the system being much higher than this was originally anticipated. This is why, with the co-legislator, the Commission will seek for a postponement by 1 year of entry into application of the EUDR, which will give the necessary time to take the measures to strengthen the IT system and guarantee a smooth entry application of the EUDR. The Commission will continue to provide the support for the information system. We have the user guide providing its functions, which is translated into all official EU languages. We have provided so far over 65 online trainings, reaching over 20,000 participants. We have educational videos on the website in multiple languages. We have a centralized help desk. We have a so-called application programming interface for those who prefer submission by a machine-to-machine connection, which is particularly true and useful for those operators, non-SME traders and non-SME operators further down the supply chain who submit diligence statements in bulk. The Commission will continue its engagement and outreach. You're also invited to subscribe to the newsletter to get more immediate information about the latest updates about the regulation.
Thank you very much, Gabor, and also for all the efforts for supporting and the materials for the support of UDR.
That brings us to the end of this episode for Forest of the Future. As you have heard, the EU deforestation regulation is currently facing a period of uncertainty. And that is, of course, very unfortunate for companies, for producer countries, and for everyone working to protect forests, because uncertainty makes action harder, not easier. But this conversation also serves as a reminder of why the legislation exists in the first place. Forest loss remains a global challenge, and voluntary action alone has not been enough to address it at the scale which is required. We hope that this episode has given you some tangible outcomes, a clearer picture of what competent authorities will actually expect, a better understanding of the legal and operational realities, and a sense of how companies can start preparing, regardless of shifting timelines. But perhaps more importantly, it underlines that a regulation cannot stand alone. Legal requirements set a baseline, but they do not by themselves deliver forest positive outcomes. That is where systems like FSC remain essential. helping to translate compliance into credible due diligence, transparency, and long-term stewardship. While EUDR may be debated or delayed, the direction of travel is clear. The need for deforestation-free, resilient supply chains is not going away. Thank you for listening to Forest of the Future. If this episode was helpful, please subscribe for more conversations on sustainability, regulation, and innovation for forest-positive supply chains. You can always reach out to me on podcast@fsc.org. I am Laura Worm, and this was Forest for the Future.